The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, plus a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Table Talk, the Spectator's food and drink podcast. I'm Lara Prendergast.
And I'm Olivia Potts.
And today we're delighted to be joined by Professor Philip Hentscher, the novelist and journalist whose books cover a wide variety of subjects, often dealing with important historical change. Among other subjects, Philip has written about the fall of the Berlin Wall, the First Afghan War, the independence of Bangladesh, and growing up in Sheffield. As a journalist, he writes regularly for us here at The Spectator, and he's also a professor of creative writing at Bath Spa University. His latest novel is To Battersea Park. Philip, welcome to Table Talk.
Hello.
Philip, we'll start where we always do, at the beginning, and ask you, what are your earliest memories of food?
My mum was a very sort of inventive cook, and I think one of the first memories I have was of her making the weekday dinner of mince and mashed potatoes, irresistible to a small boy, by christening it Nests. There was this dish called Nests, and it was just a dollop of mince in a circle of mashed potato. And that was such a kind of romantic thing for me, romantic and poetic. That was lovely. And the other thing that I remember loving when I was a very little boy was liver, which must have been very convenient for my parents living on a tight budget. I adored liver when I was a little boy. Isn't that strange?
That's a more unusual taste for a small child. And what were mealtimes like?
This is sort of the late 1960s, early 1970s. And I can hardly believe it now, but we used to say grace at every meal. And we'd have water to drink, and if we were very lucky, some orange squash, but not every day. And at the end of mealtimes, we had to say, please may I get down? And I think my mum was actually quite an adventurous cook. And I think a bit later, in the 70s, we did start to see all sorts of things like chili con carne and even, you know, even curries, homemade curries appearing on the table. Or one unforgettable dinner time when my mother went all out and she produced avgolemeno, the Greek lemon soup, which she'd found in a Reader's Digest cookbook. And I'm sorry to say that it was not a great success for my dad. And my mum got rather upset because she'd spent the whole afternoon making it. Anyway, she was a good adventurous cook, actually. And I think she kind of passed that on to me.
And did you cook with her as a child?
Yeah, definitely.
What kind of things did you make with her?
Well, my very first culinary duty when I was 5 or 6 was making the gravy on Sunday dinner. And I've always been very keen on the theory of gravy. I love making gravy. I couldn't possibly go into it. It's so baroque and detailed now. But you need a bit of flour. It needs to be something scraped up from the bottom of the pan. I've never understood it, but sometimes the joint doesn't produce enough kind of crusty stuff, and then you have to resort to artificial means. And then the potato water and something a bit more flavoured. These days it's red wine. And then whatever sort of spiced up additions you feel like. A bit of mustard, a bit of Henderson's relish, the great Sheffield equivalent of Worcestershire sauce, or anything really. And then kind of you know, go on adding liquid until it's got the right consistency. And then, after the gravy, I remember making cheese straws. And then, before you knew it, I was making biscuits. And I don't know why baking always comes first in culinary learning experiences, because baking's terribly hard, I think.
It's terribly hard, but I wonder if it's a bit more low risk in that the meal itself isn't necessarily ruined if it goes wrong. Maybe it's a sort of easier one to...
That must be it. But it goes wrong much more often than anything else, I think. Yeah.
And Philip, what about school food? What are your memories of that time of your life?
I don't really have very many, actually. I mean, I went to state school and to comprehensive and school dinners. What were they like? I can't remember anything, actually. No, I think for quite a lot of my school days, I did actually take sandwiches because my mum's sandwiches were always much nicer than anyone else's.
And what about when you left school? You went to Oxford to study. Was that more memorable than school food or less so?
Well, that was really the time when I properly started to learn to cook, and particularly when I was in a student house in my third year, I used to, dig up all sorts of things. I remember cooking spaghetti carbonara for the first time, following the instructions on the back of a packet of spaghetti. I don't suppose it came out very well because I was using all the wrong things, but it was a good start. And by the end, I could do things quite confidently. I could roast a chicken. I could make a lasagna, they would get better over time. And then I did a PhD at Cambridge, and I had the great luck of having going into a relationship with an Italian, and Italians are the best critics of food, and they will tell you immediately when something isn't right. And certainly, I would present something that I thought was perfectly good, and no, this was not good. This was absolutely not good. And the meal was wrong. The order of the meal was wrong. And what do you mean you want a cappuccino and it's 2 o'clock in the afternoon? That cannot happen. And I think that sort of rigidity and the sense of when things are correct or incorrect is not a bad one to have in your mind. Mm. And I think as my cooking's kind of gone on, I've always kind of wanted to know what is actually wrong, what is definitely and decidedly wrong, and what could be more correct. In a way, the journey that I've gone on is, you could trace it with the various carbonaras I've made over the years, and now my carbonara is so austerely perfect.
What's the secret to a carbonara?
You don't use pancetta. You don't use bacon. You use guanciale. Ew. And you use one egg and one egg yolk. No cream, of course. Ew. There's no cream. And I use Marcella Hazan's suggestion that you fry a clove of garlic in the guanciale fat first and then remove the clove and then splash it all with a bit of white wine, and then it's fine. But it's become very austere, my carbonara. I do I believe in correctness in food.
Quite right. And you spent 6 years working in the House of Commons as a clerk, and then you lost your job after your novel Kitchen Venom came out. Can you tell us, for readers who, listeners rather, who haven't come across your book, can you tell us what was in it, and particularly the kitchen part? What was that?
Well, Kitchen Venom is a phrase from a novel by one of my favourite novelists, Elizabeth Taylor, and she says that one of her characters comes out of a kitchen where her sister-in-law has been chopping parsley with more than what seemed to her kitchen venom. And I've always been fascinated by that, the way in which emotions can be taken out on small things like parsley chopping. It's about the end of Mrs. Thatcher's period, told from the point of view of House of Commons clerks, which I was one. It's scandalous, and it's full of violence and sex and you know, bad behaviour, really. I wrote it to be sacked. I was completely fed up with the House of Commons by that stage, and it worked. I loved being sacked. I can't recommend being sacked enough to people. It's had a strange sort of afterlife, that that novel, actually, because people have sort of picked it up over the years. It's never been, you know, a huge bestseller or anything, but it got a paragraph in Charles Moore's wonderful biography of Mrs. Thatcher, oddly. And there's been, you know, people occasionally write to me about it. So I think it's all right to have a novel that's still interesting a few people 27 years after it's published. You never know, maybe it will become a bestseller. Weirder things happen.
After people listen to this podcast.
Yes, why not?
You mentioned Marcella Hazan before. Are you a strict follower of recipes, or are you an inventor when it comes to being in the kitchen?
I'm a strict follower and a comparer of recipes. I adore the woman in the Guardian. Is it Flisty Cloak? Who just goes through about 20 recipes for a single thing and then produces what she thinks is the platonic essence. And I think it's completely right. I am a strict follower of recipes. I live with somebody who is very much a sort of improvisational cook, and will turn up sometimes and say, I've made this salad. And I was like, it looks as though it's a combination of mango, beetroot and horseradish. And he says, yes, that's right, isn't it delicious? And I was like, yeah. So no, I like finding out about culinary traditions. I like doing things correctly and just seeing what they're like in the kind of ideal form.
And as well as the Italian interest, Philip, what other culinary traditions have you discovered or become particularly enthusiastic about?
I've had patches with all sorts of things. A couple of years ago, my Christmas present to Zav was Fuchsia Dunlop's wonderful Szechuan cookbook.
We had her on the podcast a few years back.
Oh, she's wonderful. And a big box of Szechuan things. We've been doing that. In fact, I'm cooking a big Szechuan dinner tonight.
Mm. What are your go-to Szechuan dishes?
I love mapo tofu, the really classic one. There's a really delicious chicken with chestnuts dish that we cook all the time. And I love the bitter gourd. I do think that we don't, in this country, we don't really value bitter vegetables enough, and the bitter taste. But I think it's a wonderful thing to bounce something else off. There's a different bitter gourd that we have in Bengali cooking called Korela. My husband's Bengali, that sort of crept into all sorts of things. It's delicious next to a roast shoulder of lamb. Sometimes it needs, your guests need a bit of persuading. You know, there was one who said that it tasted like eating your own earwax, but I like it. Yeah.
And do you enjoy hosting?
Yes, I love it. I absolutely love it. I never understand what people mean when they say that they can't stand having dinner parties. They find dinner parties stressful. You know, I adore it. You just bung something in the oven that doesn't need much attention, and go for it. And then
what
kind
would
of,
be your go-to?
Oh, a shoulder of lamb. Shoulder of lamb. If you've got, you know, six people coming, and you know, then get out some oysters. You know, I always think, you know, opening a dozen oysters in front of people, it always gets a party off to a good start. Decide what cocktail you're going to have. We love a cocktail.
Right. What's your go-to cocktail for a dinner party?
At the moment, well, I think it's very important to change your cocktail from time to time and not to have the same cocktail that you were serving in 2008. Cocktails are very kind of fashionable things. So last year, the fashionable cocktail was an aviateur, strange kind of purple little drink. But this year, I've decided in a kind of unilateral way that the go-to cocktail is an aquavit sour. And that's very good. And this is just the weather for an aquavit sour, I think. But you need to keep up with cocktails.
And are there any literary references that you turn to for dinners?
You just
do it completely by, there's no kind of
book. I have a theory that all meals in novels are disgusting.
Tell us more about that. That sounds like a great theory.
See, in Proust, the Duchesse de Guermont gives her guests orange squash after dinner. What? That's insane. And I think, the Bœuf d'Aube into the lighthouse sounds awful. Sounds absolutely awful. But Virginia Woolf didn't know anything about food. Did you know in her last novel, written in 1941, a character opens a bottle of champagne with a corkscrew? She had no idea. She had no idea at all. What is good? I tell you what, there's one meal in the whole of fiction that I can think of that really sounds delicious to me. And it's when Mrs. and Miss Bates go to Emma's father's for dinner in Emma, and he orders sweetbreads and asparagus for them, but it comes. And he tastes the asparagus and he thinks the asparagus isn't done enough, so he sends it away. And I think, oh, I bet that was good. Oh, I bet that was good. Sweetbreads is one of my very favourite.
I was
going to
say,
things.
Isn't offal one of your. You're an offal man, is that right?
I am. I am. I love offal. I love offal.
In our notes.
It's partly, the. Loving liver when I was a little boy and always loving it. But I think it's kind of they're just kind of good, interesting, complicated flavours. And also there's a kind of hobby element to it. If you want to cook a brain or sweetbreads, indeed, you can't just kind of bung it in the oven. It's something that you have to prepare and soak and strip the membrane away. And am I selling it?
No. Have you done that? Have you cooked a brain?
Oh yes. We have we have a wonderful butcher in Clapham, Mr. Moen. Can I plug Mr. Moen? He's the most wonderful butcher. And they sort of know me and my awfully ways. And the other day I went in and the butcher said, I've got a lovely brain for you, sir.
How would you cook it? What's your brain speciality?
Well, if I had an hour or two, I would soak it in milk. I would poach it. I would strip away the membrane. I would cut it into slices. I would dip it in egg and breadcrumbs and then fry the slices and have that with a nice green sauce. If I was a bit more pressed for time, I would make a brain curry. I think that there is nothing more delicious than a brain curry. If you want the greatest brain curry on earth, there's only one good restaurant left on Brick Lane, and it's called Amagao, and it's really a kind of traiteur. You kind of wander in. I've never seen anybody non-Bengali in there. It's really good, and they make the best brain curry known to mankind. It's so good.
And speaking of restaurants, where else do you like? Do you enjoy eating out? And if so, where are your favourite places?
We have sort of a dozen favourite restaurants that we've been going to for years and years and years. It's a big deal when a new restaurant comes into our life that we would go to again. We very much like Bocca di Lupo in Soho. We've been going there since it opened, actually. And Ottolenghi's restaurants. Those are our kind of posh choices, I reckon. And then there are kind of fallback places. There's a Thai restaurant in Clapham that's so wonderful that I'm not going to mention it because it's busy enough. And it's very frustrating to go there and that you can't get a table on a Thursday night or something. That is frustrating, but it's wonderful. Where else? Amagao on Brick Lane is great. It's the one remaining restaurant that's actually kind of authentically Bengali cuisine. It's very, very good. And Bengali cuisine, you know, if most Indian restaurants in this country are run by Bangladeshis, mostly from Sylhet, but they kind of cook what they think you're going to like. They don't cook fish. And it's one of the great fish-eating cultures, and they don't cook the kind of vegetables that that is just so characteristic of Bengali cuisine.
Talking of fish, you are a fan of a fish market.
Yes, I was thinking.
Tell us about where does that come from?
I was thinking actually that if I really thought about the kind of half dozen absolutely transcendental meals of my life, most of them are fish. You know, one of them was a not necessarily a kind of, you know, expensive or flash one. One of them was just a fisherman on a beach in Brazil who just roasted a sea bass over a fire. Oh my God, that was good. Or if you're in Oslo early in the morning and you go down to the quay at 6 a.m, the fishermen kind of come in with bags of prawns that they've just caught and often cooked on the way back to port. Those North Sea prawns, when they're just cooked, oh, they're good. You know, I love fish, and I love fish markets.
Tell us about that. What's the kind of interest?
A really great one, when you peer into a bucket, you never know what you're going to see.
That's true.
It's absolutely extraordinary what you can see. I think my greatest fish market experience was we went to Japan on our honeymoon, and of course you get to Tokyo and it's the worst jet lag you'll ever have. And we woke up the day after arriving, it was 4 a.m, you know, so ready to go, and you know, but it was 4 a.m. So I said to Sam, I know, just around the corner, it's the Tokyo fish market. So let's go to the fish market at 4:30 a.m. And we did. Oh, my days. You know, people...
See, that is the time to go.
That is the time to go. See the tuna auction, to go and have, you know, the greatest sushi in the world for your breakfast.
Can you eat that? Can you eat the market?
Yeah. Well, you could. This is 20 years ago now. But the market was absolutely surrounded by sushi bars, and oh my God, it was good. It was absolutely
really
sensational.
Good.
It has moved now. There was some kind of talk about excluding tourists from it, but I hope not. I hope not. I haven't been back since then.
And Philip, when you're writing, I mean, well, I put this question into two parts. When you're writing, what is your kind of, do you have any routines that you follow, particularly with kind of food and drink? And also, do you like to incorporate food into your own writing? You've said you don't like it in other writing, but
yeah.
Do you incorporate it into yours?
Incorporate it less and less, I think. I think it's quite difficult to ignore it as a novelist because it's such a good guide to character, what your characters are like, and also to where and when they are. You know, I wrote a novel about change of England between kind of the mid-1970s and the mid-1990s, and a very kind of easy way of doing that it was just to kind of go into the difference between what people served at parties in the mid-70s and what they were starting to hand out in mid-90s, you know, suddenly.
So it's a bit like your cocktail.
Yes. And I think that's something that we hardly notice. But if you were given a 1970s dinner party now, you wouldn't believe it. You really wouldn't believe it.
You'd think it was ironic, wouldn't you? Now you'd be probably very fashionable to.
But I mean, some of it was really good. One of my favourite cookbooks is Simon Hopkinson's The Prawn Cocktail Years, and it looks as though it's going to be a kind of ironic sort of book. But he's really gone into what those recipes were like, and some of them, it's just sensationally good recipes. The bœuf bourguignon I do all the time, and his Yeah. So I was just thinking about the domestic catastrophe that happened the first time I cooked beef bourguignon, because he calls for a pig's trotter split down the middle to be. And you always have to conceal the worst kind of crimes of offal from Zav, because he doesn't really like that sort of thing. And I had to pretend up to the last moment that Mr. Moen had by mistake put in a pig's trotter, and then throw the pig's trotter away. And anyway, it was just terrible.
And is there anything that you, when you're writing, that you find yourself eating or drinking particularly?
Well, I try to be a mealtime sort of person and stick to breakfast, lunch and dinner, with tea is a very occasional treat with a cake. So, breakfast is just breakfast, you know, whatever needs to be done. I write, if I'm writing a novel, then I write between 7:30 and 10. So after that, my day is mine, really. And
preparing the brain, or
yes, preparing a brain, yes. And it's a very nice, relaxation, I think, cooking. You know, there's nothing nicer than spending half an hour meditatively peeling beetroot or something. I love that.
And what is comfort food for you, Philip?
A risotto, I think.
To make or to eat or both?
Both, yeah, both. And as simple as possible, I think. A risotto milanese with saffron in it is just so soothing. And there's something miraculous about it. I love those transformative recipes that you know, you can't really believe that it's going to happen, but it does happen in the end. What else? What else is comfort food? Liver and onions. That would be very comforting to me. Yeah.
And do you have a sweet tooth?
I don't, actually. No, it's an odd one. It's fine, you know, I'll eat it, but I can't, I always have to, if I have people round for dinner, I always have to remember, oh yes, you've got to make a dessert.
What would you make?
A rice pudding, maybe, or I don't know. It's, yeah, it's not. The incentive to making rice pudding is that I very often have it with the one flavour combination that I believe I've invented. And I think it's brilliant, but I just had this vision of it one day. And it's rhubarb and lavender. And it's absolutely brilliant. Not an enormous amount of lavender, just
a
pinch. You
infuse the milk with... Is it lavender?
No, you just... I have it with a sort of... a dollop of rhubarb to have alongside the...
lavender's in the rhubarb with...
The lavender's in the rhubarb with some sugar. And there's something about the two flavours. They harmonise very well together. Olivia, try it out.
I will. You'll see it in 6 weeks' time in the Vintage Chef. I'll have come up with this incredible combination that no one will have thought of before. And weirdly, your podcast won't air. I mean, it's no coincidence.
No, I don't need. I don't need credit. But I don't think. I genuinely think that it's the only combination of flavours I've ever invented. You know, and I don't expect it ever to happen again. But anyway, so that's why I have rice pudding, because it goes very well with rhubarb and lavender.
And so to end, we like to ask our guests what their desert island meal would be, which we sort of mean ultimate meal, death row meal. We're not going to make you, unless you want to be fishing for your own fish on a desert island. You don't have to do that. What would be your absolute ideal meal to end on?
Oh, I think it would definitely be oysters, 9 oysters, because 6 is never enough and 12 is too many. 9 oysters, sweetbreads with asparagus, and to finish, a cheese that I'd never had before. I think that's one of the great joys. You can
what would be a cheese?
I think that's the joy, that every so often a cheese does suddenly surface that you've never had before. It's kind of inexhaustible, the world of cheeses.
It's true. What's come to your attention recently? What have you discovered?
There's a mad Swiss cheesemonger in London called Yumi, J-U-M-I, and they do experimental Swiss cheeses, and one of the ones they've come up with is called a blue brain. And it's a blue cheese, but they ask very rationally, why does the blue mould have to go through cheese in veins? Why not just encase the cheese in a layer of mould? And then you eat the mould as well. And it's, I have to say, it's psychologically quite challenging at
first.
How does
it look? So it looks like a whole ball of mould.
Yeah, and if you get the old one, it's very shriveled. Anyway, I get the young one. It's absolutely delicious cheese. It really is. But you have to kind of gird yourself up to think, I am going to eat a layer of mould. I don't think anyone's died yet from
it. No, well, on that note, Philip, thank you very much for joining us on Table Talk.
Thank you very much for asking.